Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the island-chained paradise in the sunny slave South Pacific, with such wonderful Fukushima radiation that helps all the sunbathers soak up the rays. And my very special guest today is Marty Leeds. Marty, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on, man.
And just like Back to the Future, his computer also requires 1.21 gigawatts. Now, would you be able to give us a bit of a preface and an explanation about who you are, what it is you do, and what we're going to be talking about today?
Sure. I am basically what I'm known for is uncovering a cipher, or what's known as a cryptogram, basically a number letter to correlation cipher for the English alphabet. And this is based on a lot of like secret society symbols, religious symbols, things like that. And so that's kind of what I'm known for. MartyLeeds33.com is my website. You can get my lecture series. I have a free lecture series, like 40 or so lectures up right now. I just posted one today, in fact, on the Hebrew alphabet. So that's all available on YouTube, MartyLeeds33. And then I have a couple books for sale. I just released two books on the end of January. One's called The Peacock's Tales, the Alchemical Writings of Claudia Pavonis. And then Pie in the English Alphabet, Volume 1, which is a second edition I did. And then I have this Volume 2, the second edition, should actually be out, I'm hoping, next week. So those three books available on my site. You can get them on Amazon.com. And yeah, that's kind of me in a nutshell anyway.
And you contacted me. You wanted to come on the show, and you said you had a few things prepared. What are they?
Well, it depends on what you want to go into. I mean, I know we have quite a lot of time.
You know me, bro. I go into anything. Unless it involves me actually, except unless it involves me personally committing scumbaggery, unless I'm not keen on it. But if it involves scumbaggery or anything else, even like mystical, it might even be unproven. It could be theoretical. I don't care. Everybody's got a story, and every bit of information counts, even if it's not true.
Sure. So yeah, there's a bunch of stuff we can go into. I figured we could go into the cipher and explain that and show. I've got some things I can show to show some of the symbolism so you can actually see it. And I know if people are listening to this, you can go in online and check this stuff out yourself. You know, we got Google nowadays. It takes like 2 seconds. So, but I was thinking that we could go into the history of it. We could go into, you know, like I said, explain the cipher and then maybe just break down a few things, possibly the name of Jesus Christ. We could look at Holy Bible. We could look at Skull and Bones. We could look at, there's just a bunch of different things that we could look at and really break down and show why this thing works, why it's important, and then maybe even go into I don't know how else to say this, but the divine nature of mathematics. Yeah. And kind of understanding that. So I don't know where you want to start. We could explain the cipher maybe, or sure. Go into the history of it.
Obviously, it's better to explain the cipher, then go into the history of it, because that actually gives us a good grounding for an actual discussion.
Sure. Okay, so basically what I did is I've been studying sacred geometry, sacred number, occult sciences, philosophy, psychology, these sorts of things for quite a while, probably, you know, intensely for about 5 years or something like that, I'd say. And on and off on my whole life, too. But so basically what I did is this science is called gematria. It's also known as Kabbalah. It's called, I think it's in Greek, it's called isospathy or something like that. I can never pronounce that. But it's basically this idea of putting numbers to letters. And this was a very ancient, like, occult science. Many cultures have done this. We know we still have ciphers for the Greek and Hebrew languages. I actually print them in the back of my books. And so we know that texts like the Holy Bible, when they were originally written, were written with this mathematical foundation. And this is what's important. So basically what I'm saying is that when the new King James Version, this authorized version, which we'll get into the history of this, was written, it was written mathematically. And this is how you're supposed to read these texts. And so that's, you know, just a little preface there. So what I did is I took the 26 letters of the English alphabet and I split them in half. So we have 26 letters and I split them in A through M and N through Z. And then what I did is I just walked up the motif that we see in the Holy Bible with the 6 days of God doing work and then resting on the seventh. And this is, of course, a mythological motif. It's nothing literal about this. So I sent A through M and N through Z. And so I went A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and then I stopped. So I went 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and I stopped at that G. And then what I did is I ended up just walking back down to H-I-J-K-L-M being 6-5-4-3-2-1. Now, why this is important in stopping at that G is, of course, let me just grab this here. We all know this symbol very well.
Oh, yeah.
That's the Freemasonic square and compasses, and that's a big old fat G right there.
I thought that was a rap group called G Unit.
I'm not sure. Are they Freemasons?
I don't know. I think they're just slaves like the rest of us.
They have no idea they're being manipulated by the Freemasonic Council, right? So basically, A through M, I walked up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, arrested on that G, H, I, J, K, L, M, B, and 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Now, by splitting the alphabet 13 letters and 13 letters, what I did is I just took those letters and I threw them onto the other side of the alphabet. Just symmetry, balance is basically what you're doing. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, we're just going to throw that to it. So N-O-P-Q-R-S-T. UVWXYZ is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, resting on that T, and then UVWXYZ is 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And really what this does is it shows that the cipher was built on like these strong philosophical constants, things like symmetry, balance, things like that. And if you look at your entire body, I mean, just starting from your head, of course. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, actually finish your point.
So by splitting the alphabet, the reason that I split the alphabet in the first place is because if you just look, your body's completely mirrored. Your whole entire body's mirrored. Your brain pan's mirrored, your eyes are mirrored, nostrils, your teeth are even mirrored, ears, shoulders, hands, etc. So I basically took testicles. Yes, that's right. So I took this idea and I just threw it onto the English alphabet. And then I used the motif, as I said, in the Holy Bible, walking up to this G. Now, why this is important is, I'll show this here. Is what you can do is with this is pull out the non-prime numbers in your alphabet. So once again, we went A through M. I'm just going to focus on that. And this is the non-prime prime number is a number divisible by 1 in itself. So a non-primes would be 1, 4, 6, and 6, 4, 1 in our alphabet. So 1 plus 4 plus 6 plus 6 plus 4 plus 1 equals 22. And this leads us right to the central 7, that G, where we stopped. And 22 divided by 7 is an approximation of pi begotten by whole numbers. It's 22 divided by 7 is 3.142. And so you can see, hopefully I can show this here, but I've got this on my site. You can double check all this stuff for free if you'd like. But you can see here, I'll show this. That is the Jewish menorah, and that is highlighting the non-prime numbers in our cipher.
For those, the uninitiated and those listening on the radio, the Jewish menorah, did you say? It's kind of like a quintessential thing on Hanukkah, the many, many sticks of the candles and the candelabra, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a 7-branch menorah. That's, I think there's a 7 and 9-branch menorah, I want to say, but this is using the 7-branch menorah. So what this is showing is actually you can use this symbol to deconstruct our English alphabet and create pi. And pi is an infinite transcendental number. It's and this is an approximation of pi, of course. But pi is a ratio of a circle's circumference to its diameter. And it's a very key number. It's a constant in mathematics. And so this number is, it's a very important number. And so we find this number in our A through M in our alphabet. Well, because we had the symmetry, we had that balance, we just had a mirror, if you will. We just took those numbers and threw it on the other side. We have the exact same thing on the other side. So we have A through M, N through Z, both encoding pi and resting on the one side on that G. And then, of course, on the other side is the T. And if you know anything about Freemasonic symbols, what that T is actually referencing is another mathematical thing called the Tau cross. And the Tau cross is actually a symbol for man. I don't really want to get into that here, but if you can check that out, just Google that. Just do Google Tau cross, and you're going to see some Freemason symbols there. So that said, so what this does is establish the cipher for the English alphabet. Now, that's just one way of deconstructing this, right? Now, there's a couple different ways. Number one, we just put pi on one side of the alphabet and pi on the other, right? So this is 2 pi. And this pi is begotten by 7. It's 22 divided by 7 to give you this 3.142. Well, this right here, and what this symbol is, and you can look this up once again, this is called the Tetragrammaton. And this is the holy name of God. And if you can see that very clearly, that says pi 7. Pi 7. And so what this is saying
for those listening in the radio audience as well, that's a diamond shape with kind of like floral patterns around the outside of the diamond, and within the diamond you actually have the number 7 and the symbol for pi twice side by side.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Yeah. So, and there's a bunch of different symbolic representations of this, and all of them are very similar. So it's basically, and this thing is called the Tetragrammaton. And what the Tetragrammaton is, the holy name of God. And this was known as Yahweh or Jehovah, right? And the Tetragrammaton, well, gramma means message. And this is where we get the word grammar, of course. And so it stands to reason that this holy name of God, this Jehovah, this Yahweh, that a lot of people have a lot of misconceptions about, by the way, and we'll get into this, but that this thing is encoded within our alphabet. And then understanding that these sacred texts were written mathematically, this allows you to understand what exactly they were talking about when they talk about God. They're not talking about a bearded man in the sky who sits in a cloud, who plays a mean harp that's got a long beard and a big penis. You know, that's not what they're talking about. They're talking about something. Really, what they're talking about is a nature force, and that this nature force can be understood through geometry and number. So this is why some of this is important. So I just wanted to show that. I also wanted to show this. This is the Ouija board.
Everybody knows what a Ouija board is.
Everybody knows what a Ouija board is. If you can see there, that's splitting the alphabet A through M. N through Z, and where does it arch up to? The G and T. That's exactly where we stopped in our alphabet.
Oh, wow.
You can look up the Ouija board. This is what's known as the emblem of Israel. Oh, see if I can get this in the screenshot there.
It's the seven-stick candelabra with olive branches on the left and the right. It's like a shield as well with writing down the bottom. What is that writing? Is that Hebrew?
Yeah, it's Hebrew. That means it's Israel. I think this is Lamed Shin. I'm going to get that wrong. So, but it's Hebrew.
It's probably pronounced with some way, you know.
yeah, exactly. So why this is important is, of course, we just saw that we separated the non-prime numbers and that led to the G and T, right? Well, this is exactly what this is symbolizing here. And then if you notice on this side here, there is, I'm sorry if I'm getting this wrong. There's 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, or A, B, C, D, E, F, and then G. And you have the exact same thing going down. H, I, J, K, L, M.
Well, you're talking about the numbers of the two olive branches on either sides actually mimic the six leaves going up and one leaf at the top and then all the way back down again. So you've got 13 leaves on both sides and the top leaf symbolizing the T and the G.
Yes, exactly. So what's being said here is this is the cipher, the gematria for our English alphabet. And not only this, is we can actually take some of this into Hebrew as well, which we don't have time to really go into right now. But basically, that's what I wanted to show that there's multiple ways and multiple symbols to get this very particular number to letter correlation. So
this conversation is making me feel a bit like I have in a G&T.
So. You're throwing me off, man. So, okay, that's what you do. So all of those different symbols, the Ouija board, the Tetragrammaton, the Freemasonic square and compasses, of course, the emblem of Israel, etc. There's a couple other different ways that you can decode the cipher as well that I've got videos on. You can use dice to decode this, and you can also use the chromatic music scale to find this very particular number to letter correlation. So that's the cipher, and we can go into the applicability of this cipher and why it's so important. But I just wanted to lay that out, and maybe we can try to go into some of the history of it, if you'd like.
Go for your life.
So Freemasonry was established in a very particular time, and this is well-known by, like Albert Mackey talks about this, Albert Pike talks about this. This is just well-known in history that Freemasonry was established, and of course it's a reimagination of a lot of these other secret societies. Well, this was established in like the 16th and 17th century we're talking about. Basically what we're going to do is carve out a chunk of time, like 1450 around there to like, 1650, 1500s to 1650, somewhere around there. Now, a whole bunch of really, really interesting things was going on at this point in our history. At this point in our history, we know for a fact that the 26 letters of our English alphabet that we use right now was established at this time. Now, how do we know this? The first dictionaries were being printed. First dictionary was printed in 1604, and this was a dictionary dedicated to the 26 letters of our English alphabet. We had a renaissance of thought going on at the time. We basically had some of the greatest artisans, scientists that were living at this time, Copernicus, Kepler, Galileo, Giordano Bruno, Francis Bacon, Rene Descartes, all of these guys, artists like Michelangelo, Raphael, Leonardo, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, all of them. So a bunch of really great artists, Renaissance thinkers. We also had a rise in alchemy at this time. So once again, we're talking 1500 to 1650. John D. Edward Kelly, just some of the most famous alchemists of all time. They were living at this time. Johann Daniel Milius, Michael Mayer, Anastasius Kircher, Henrik Nolius. Just some really, really famous alchemists. If you're not familiar with these guys, all you have to do is, once again, just do a Google search. So we had the first dictionaries being printed, a renaissance of thought, rise of alchemy. You also had the original Greek Holy Bible was being translated into modern English at this time. So this was 1611 this happened. So we had King James and his 72 translators translating the original Greek into the modern English the modern English Bible. So that was going on. You also had what was known as this great vowel shift, where there was literally a change in our alphabet at this time. There was a little change in how we spoke vowels at this time. And so you had all of that. You had the establishment of Freemasonry. And then you also had a man named William Shakespeare living at this time. So all of this, we know for a fact that our English language was being established at this time. We had all of this stuff going on. And William Shakespeare was living at this time. And now we know that, you know, William Shakespeare was basically, there's a lot of evidence to say that he wasn't a singular man, that this was basically a guild of writers, of alchemists, of artisans, of astrologers, of, you know, et cetera, poets that were getting together and creating these, you know, the sonnets and plays and things like that.
Sir Ken Robinson talked about education and this kind of thing, and he wondered who was William Shakespeare's English teacher. You know, what was it like for William Shakespeare being a seven-year-old boy? You know, Shakespeare, go to bed and stop talking like that. You're confusing people.
That's funny, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, he widely regarded as one of the greatest literary figures of all time, right? I mean, there's really no question about that. I mean, he wrote some of the greatest literary works of all time. And, of course, this was probably, like I said, a guild of writers that were doing this. Now, William Shakespeare gave us over 20,000 words of our modern English language. And so I get criticized, yes, and this is well known. Once again, this is just modern academia will say this. So, you know, I get criticized a lot for being, you know, creative or that sort of thing, imaginative with language, and yet poetic, if you will. And yet a poet gave us a whole chunk of our language. So that really needs to, you know, be cognizant of that when we go and try to deconstruct language. We can't really deconstruct it in this very mechanistic, very, you know, rigid kind of way, because
that's kind of crazy. It's imposing rules where rules are changeable and rewritable, right? That's why I call them academia nuts.
Yeah, exactly. That, I mean, that's really what it is. I mean, academia wants to look at everything in this sort of boxed fashion, this very just, it's only critical thinking. It's only, if you will, the left hemisphere of your brain thinking. And this is just stifling us in so many different ways, especially when it comes to linguistics and philology and our history as well. So. So that's it. So let me just go over this one more time. What was going on at this time period? Let's say 1500 to 1650. You had the first dictionaries being printed. You had the rise of a resurgence of alchemy. You had a renaissance of thought. You had the King James Bible being translated from the original Greek. You had William Shakespeare. You know, you had a great vowel shift happening. And you had, to top it all off, you had the establishment of Freemasonry at this time. And like I just said, I got this cipher from a Freemason symbol directly. And this is what this is encoding. And so there's a really, really strong historical case, or this is a really good historical case or context for what was going on at this time and why this cipher, if you will, is correct. And so this is, you know, a lot of evidence to say that, yeah, this is what was going on. It's very well known. And of course, we have other languages that have ciphers. And a lot of the language, our language was based on, you could say, Middle English, Latin, Greek, Hebrew, without question. And, you know, here we are.
So now you're specifically talking about the Renaissance. Is this 17th or 18th century?
Well, there, I mean,
1600s and 1700s, or
yeah, basically you're looking at from, you know, carving out, like I said, like probably like 1500 to 1650. You kind of had this Renaissance of thought. I mean, Da Vinci was before that, and of course he had the Italian Renaissance as well. But I mean, this is really kind of tumbling. There was a lot going on at this time of our history.
Somebody told me once that during that period of time there was an enormous spread of mushroom spores, magic mushroom spores, and because people weren't washing their food, washing the dirt out of their food and what have you, they were actually consuming a lot of these hallucinogenic mushrooms, and this person alleged that that was part of the reason why the Renaissance happened, is because, and why all these new thoughts and ideas and things started to come out, is because people were starting to trip.
That very well could. I mean, it's pretty, you know, it's a lot of conjecture. It's a lot of just, you know, we don't really know, but I mean, very well. I mean, when you look at, you know, the 60s and 70s, so whatever you think about that era or whatever you think about it, you know, there was a lot of great music and things that came out, a lot of great art, a lot of great philosophy, a lot of great new ideas, I would say. A lot of bad ideas, too, don't get me wrong. But, you know,
The 70s is, I believe, the only decade throughout the entirety of history where behavior during that decade is excused because it was that decade, you know? Hey, it was the 70s.
That's a good point, man. I never thought about that. Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, because if that was going on now, well, that is kind of going on now. Look, we're getting beat by cops. And of course, that was happening then, too. You know, I think it's just at a different scale now, right? They just have more guns and more mace and more tasers and, you know, a bigger government. And so, anyway.
We don't have quite as many excuses as those in the 70s once had, you know.
Yeah. So to get back to, you know, what we're talking about here. So, yeah, that's the history of it. So kind of explaining the cipher. All the different ways you can build the cipher, and then the history of it. And the reason that I want to kind of lay this out is basically because, because of modern science, because of the way that we look at critical thinking. A lot of times critical thinking, or quote-unquote critical thinkers, will look at something and, you know, the fundamental tenets of modern science is to attack the first premise. So, okay, saying the first premise is wrong. Your cipher is incorrect. There's no way it could be correct, right? So we're going to attack the first premise, and therefore everything after, everything you talk about, every book that you write, every, you know, video or lecture that you put forward is incorrect. Well, what I'm trying to lay out is a very rational, very logical, very reasonable case as to why this cipher is correct, not only the multiple ways that you can build it, but also with the historical context as well. And so that's why I kind of wanted to say that. Another really interesting thing about this is yet again follows the fundamental tenets of science. And what I'm saying is it's empirical, it's repeatable, it's verifiable. And not only that, it follows what's known as like the principle of parsimony or Occam's razor. You probably know about this, right?
I know. It's used as one of the best excuses for not listening to anybody about any new information that the person fundamentally doesn't agree with their beliefs. Occam's razor is really handy.
What? Say that again? I'm sorry.
Occam's razor, in many of the cases when I've been talking to people who have been using it, use Occam's razor as an excuse to not believe anything or even look into any kind of information that they fundamentally don't agree with their belief structures. It's kind of being misused in that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, like 9/11. It's like, oh, okay. Yeah, I get what you're saying. Absolutely. So Occam's razor, though, in like scientific mechanics, though, is the idea that, okay, we have an explanation. We have two explanations for a phenomenon. You're going to most often choose the simpler one. Well, in this cipher, we use the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 four different times. Well, that's very, very simple. And when you look at it in that sort of mindset, then you really say that, okay, well, what's more correct? Is it using the numbers 1 through 26? Or is it, or are we going to go through something simple to 1 through 7? Well, that's, you know, or use a septenary system, which means a system of seven, basically. And so that, once again, that follows, once again, the fundamental tenets of modern science. So
and how many deadly,
I just kinda wanna lay that out.
How many deadly sins are there?
There's seven. Well, you know, the number seven isn't lost here because the number seven is just extremely important throughout all mythology, throughout all history.
It's funny that you mention that because I remember there was a board game done by Parker Brothers called The Game of Life. I'm not sure if you've ever heard this, but when I was playing it, I think I was 8 years old, I think. And sometimes you pick up a card and it gives you a lucky number. And mine was seven. And I've actually been kind of thinking that it was just a game, but to me, seven really resonated with me, and it's actually been kind of my lucky number ever since. It's since expanded for that from seven being my lucky number to include the number 33, and I live at number 33. My desk was bought that holds all these computers and everything with which I expose scumbaggery. My desk, when we were at the auction, was lot 33. And there's just so many others. It just pops up all over the place. It's like it's surrounding me.
Yeah. Well, that just proves you're a Satanist.
Yeah, totally.
And me too, apparently, because I'm Marty Lee 33. So yeah, it's really interesting how absolutely. I mean, people tell me this all the time when they come and watch the videos, or you know, send me an email or something like that, is that numbers have been surrounded by with them their entire lives. That numbers will keep popping up again and again and again, whether it's 333, 1111, 33, 7. You know, I had this one guy said that his entire life was surrounded by the number 23, and it was only that when he saw my video, it was like it started to actually make sense to him why. And maybe we can get into what numbers are. Let's just go to there. Let's go to geometry and numbers. You know, according to some of the greatest... Sorry, go ahead.
Can I say one thing? I learned Japanese once, and what struck me as very interesting is that the numbers in Japanese were exactly the same as the numbers in English. Like, numbers everywhere kind of appeared exactly the same. But I'm not sure if there were actually different symbols in Japanese for numbers, or whether or not they were using the exact same kind of symbols that we use in the English language. I'm not sure if you know anything about this.
No, I don't.
I presume every language must have different symbols for like 1, 2, 3, and 4 and all the different numbers, right?
Yeah, I think. I mean, there is a lot of, especially when you look at letters as well, too, that, I mean, there's a lot of cross-cultural, that they share a lot of the same elements, a lot of the same themes in letters, you know, like, and especially when there's numbers put to these alphabets. But when you look at like, you know, the alphabet is Hebrew. The alphabet is Latin. The alphabet is English. You know, there's Aleph Ba is Syriac, I want to say. You know, you have Alpha Beta is Greek, etc. You know, you have the same themes coming up again and again. And so I think that whether there's been an evolution or it's crafted from these other languages and things like that, I think numbers fall in the same category, if you know what I'm saying.
Perhaps there was a dissolution. You know, when you go across America, you have all these different accents and different usage of words, sayings, and things of that nature. But you understand that they all came from the same root of the colonization, and then they spread out and it became so different over time. What if way long ago all language, all culture, laws, mathematics, and everything existed within one culture, and then from there they spread out all over the earth and started to change a little bit with their own little dialects over long periods of time?
Yeah, very well could. I mean, I guess when you look at the Tower of Babel, right, the confusion of tongues, you have this idea that there was one language spoken. Of course, this is very cryptic. I think it's very metaphorical. But at the same time, we could have a concentration of group of people, and then, yeah, you know, a flood, a pole shift, a tsunami, or, you know, something happened that spread people out, etc. And then, of course, the languages changed. We have a tendency to look at language as in a very Darwinian evolution kind of sense, that languages just evolve and they are not created or whatever. And we really don't
know. Tell that to Gene Roddenberry, who created the language of Klingon.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Or John Dee created the Enochian language. Of course, he said that he received it, or, you know, channeled it, or whatever he said. But yeah, I mean, there's ample evidence that languages could be created, and probably were created with a deep understanding of nature, I would say, a deep understanding of the human being and his relationship to the divine, the cosmos, the universe, etc. So, and when you look at the evolution of language, you know, saying it, well, languages do evolve. Of course, dialects evolve. You know, inflections evolve, new words are created, sure, absolutely. But do languages evolve? We don't really know. In fact, the evidence points to say they don't evolve. How long has Hebrew been around? The 22 letters in the 5 finals of Hebrew have been around for at least 2,500 years, if not way before that. 24 letters of Greek, same thing.
May I make a point of agreement with you here that languages don't evolve? I think they devolve, though. They certainly do. I mean, for example, about 100 years ago, if a man who knew you saw you in the street, he would remove his top hat, say, hello, sir, how goes the morrow? How was your family? And all of that kind of stuff. And that's been shortened over time to sup.
I mean, honestly, you know, I don't know if this is in a cosmic sense. I think this is done deliberately. But yes, we are being devolved right now. We are being dumbed down, and we are, you know, that sort of thing. So, yeah, I mean, of course, that's, you know, so languages, of course, are going to follow that, you know. I mean, this is thanks to our wonderful school system, of course, right, and wonderful governments and politicians and whatnot. So.
And the academia nuts who defend it against all enemies, foreign and domestic, regardless of whether or not they can think or think critically, because university doesn't teach critical thinking anymore. It only teaches you to be critical of people who can still think despite going to university.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, the other thing we're talking about too, about critical thinking and imaginative thinking, I think it's a holistic approach, of course, right? That to truly understand the world, you have to have both, if you will, hemispheres of your brain, both modes of thinking working. So not only do we have the degradation of our school systems and the manipulation and the conditioning of our school systems with the loss of critical thinking, they don't even teach imaginative thinking at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, how many school systems have lost music programs, have lost dance, have lost all of these things? And that's exactly what that, you know, that lightens up this side of your brain.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, it's a tragedy.
It's the brain equivalent of a, let's say, a world champion runner, gold medalist, Olympic athlete runner, saying, you know what, maybe I can just do without my left leg or my right leg or something like that, you know, and just be like, and I'll probably still run as far. No! Nobody would do that because it's insane. Yet we psychologically do that to other people and to ourselves.
Yeah, that is a great analogy, by the way. I mean, that's a perfect analogy because it's saying, hey, go run a marathon, but only use one leg, you know? So, yeah, great. So, we were kind of talking about the evolution of language, and I just kind of wanted to address that a little bit, too, that we really don't know if languages evolve, you know? And we do have an old English, a middle English, and then a modern English, right? But there's nothing saying that modern English wasn't built off, you know, themes and elements, an understanding of Latin as and Middle English and Hebrew and Greek and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. And I think that that's actually, I think there's more evidence to point to that. And then, of course, then once again, when we look at the history of it, we're talking about, you know, all of this amazing things going on at this time. So,
And English is a conglomeration of a number of different European languages. I mean, when I'm learning them, I see so many similar words in Spanish and English, French and English, German and English. There's even some Russian words in English and what have you here or there. But it occurs to me that Latin seems to be a big part of it. Now, kind of a lot older language than, or at least one of the more older written languages, because I think the Romans came up with literacy and what have you a little bit before, say, the Germanic and the Goths and the other ancient cultures, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, Latin's been around for a long time. I mean, that was the language that was spoken in the church. That was the language that the Bibles were written in. That was the language of the Holy Roman Empire. And of course, we know all the wonderful things that the Holy Roman Empire has done. So, I mean, yeah, and especially when you look at Latin too. Latin is, I mean, it's basically the exact same letters. Not even basically, it's the exact same letters of the English alphabet, save for three letters, B, W, and J. And yet, look at how Latin is spoken. I can't speak Latin. I can't understand it. I mean, the syntax is different. The orthography is different, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. And so here we have the exact same letters, essentially, save for three letters, and yet a completely different language.
Maybe because the people who were speaking Latin didn't want anybody thinking they could have a J while they were driving their VW.
Did you just come up with that?
Yeah, I'm sorry. That was just terrible.
No, it's funny. I was like, anyway, yeah, that's great. So we kind of went over the history, went over the cipher, and kind of went over the evolution of language. So I don't know where you want to take this, or if there's anything that you
talked about Jesus and his name in the cipher.
I was thinking about before going into that, maybe talking about the secret societies just a little bit before going into that.
Sure.
To try to understand really what these secret societies, the knowledge that they're holding. When this was begotten by a Freemason symbol. Then we'll go into Jesus here. So it's in my opinion that the original inception of Freemasonry, just like the original inception of Christianity, was a noble, just, you know, holy institution. Right. And that this institution was trying to pass on the deep occult knowledge of great antiquity, the arcane science of old, basically. One of these sciences being gematria. And that they knew that throughout time, people were going to try to usurp and, you know, dumb people down, just like we're seeing it right now, usurp this knowledge and keep it for themselves. Right. And that originally, Freemasonry was trying to pass on this knowledge. And I think that because there's so much aura and mystery and secrecy around Freemasonry, I think the reason for that is that eventually people would go and be like, what are these people doing? What's going on behind those doors? And start questioning. And then when they start questioning, they'll go and look at these symbols, look at these rituals, you know, look at all of this stuff, and then allow this information to come out again. And that's an interesting claim, because most people have, they have these preconceptions about what Freemasonry is. It's an evil organization. It's the Illuminati. It's New World Order, this sort of thing. And are there factions that have infiltrated these groups? Yeah, I of course. Right. I mean, there can be no question about it. But the thing that we have to ask ourselves is why? Why do these extremely powerful people go and go towards this secret society? Why would they do that? Is it just because it's an old boys club? Or is it because they know that there is actual knowledge, deep occult knowledge about the science of, I'll just say this, the science of what it is to be a human being? That's what I think that these people are holding.
Frederick X has been a member of 9 different occult orders, and he has come out and said that there are a number of different kinds of Masons within Freemasonry. There are what are known as porch Masons, who go to the lodge to hang out with the guys and get away from their wives. There are numerical Masons who go there and study and are really obsessed with numerology and occult knowledge of that thing. There are geometrical Masons who are obsessed with angles, shapes, geometry, that kind of thing. There are symbolism Masons who are obsessed with the meanings behind symbols and symbology and what have you. And I forget if there's another kind.
Psychopathic?
No. These are just the different fields and branches of research that Freemasons go into, according to Freda. I only just had it there. There's the linguistic Masons as well, who are obsessed with the languages, the letters, the spellings, and that kind of thing. So, what you've got is you've got 5 different spectra of different interests, different reasons why people are there. Actually, political Masons was the one I was forgetting. Those who are actually there, and this is only one small section of general Freemasonry, who are there to network and gain political power through those networks, because people of power and influence do reside within Masonry. It's by all means not the greatest power hub in all the world, but this is the reason why those people come into it. And again, this stretches the point that some are in it for no good reason at all. Some are in it for occult mysticism reasons, to understand the human condition, and some of them are there because they want to use the organization and its secrecy in their quest for power.
Yeah, that's brilliantly. Yeah, you laid it out just perfectly, I would say. Yeah. I mean, I think there's, yeah, I mean, you're totally right. I mean, I think there's a bunch of Freemasons that get together, want to get rid, you know, be away from their wives and hang out with the boys. Some people are in it for deep occult knowledge, though I think there's a lot. I think there's more and more people like that coming about, but now I think it's more that there's an infestation of that latter, you know, of the political people that want the power, you know. I don't know, though. I'm not a Freemason, so Frater X would know a lot more about this than I would in that, because he's been there. So,
and one of the other elements that James Robert Wright, who's just recently come out, and he did a genealogy test on himself. You wouldn't believe the results that came up, bro. Like,
really?
JFK, Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands, Bill Clinton, just so many. Even Charlemagne, bro. What the? he was all tied in. He sent me like 22 emails. He's even related to Diana, the Princess of Wales, and Prince Charles as well. And he's only just discovered that he's part of all these bloodlines, and he's like freaking out. And what he's done is that he's turned whistleblower on Freemasonry. He was a 32nd degree employed member of the Supreme Council of the 33rd degree in Dallas, the most powerful branch of Freemasonry on Earth, pretty much. Maybe perhaps outside of the network of Nexus in Washington, D.C. However, what he concluded, that the point of the 33 degree systems, normal blue lodges and what have you, they only have 3 degrees, and those are only the basic ones for knowledge of Freemasonry. And what he discovered, or at least what his conjecture is that the 33 degrees are simply rites to ripen up a human soul for demon possession.
Wow, I completely disagree with that. I couldn't disagree with that more.
He's been there, done that, had all these 33rd degree Masons have sexual passes at him, and they were married, and he was gay, and they just knew so, and they wanted to do all of this kind of things. You have Freemason whistleblowers throughout history who just disappear, even get shot in their police cells when they're there, or disappear off the side of the street into a coach for speaking out against Freemasonry. So again, this talks about the element, and there are only 99 33rd degree Freemasons in the entire world. 99, all right? Those are the ones that he believes have in fact been ripened up.
Okay, yeah, so, I mean...
But you'd have to read all the information, actually, probably interview him yourself in order to get that kind of thing there. This is just a bit of a taster for the uninitiated generate some interest for that study, because I would actually like to see the proof of this, you know, but again, this is one person who was there who did that and... has come out and turned whistleblower and has been had his life under threat basically ever since.
Okay, let me say a few things about that, because I would challenge that directly. Now, if there is some like 33 levels of satanic worship or something like that, that is not the original intention of Freemason.
No, absolutely.
Once again, this
not.
Is yeah, this is just the
we're talking about the Scottish Rite specifically.
Oh, yeah.
Because the Scottish Rite was taken up out of Albert Pike's writings. Albert Pike spoke a number of languages, was fairly high up in Freemasonry. He even led a Cherokee Indian battalion or something of that nature in the American Civil War or something. I forget exactly. But apparently, and Freda X has confirmed this, the Scottish Rite is attempting to take over the entirety of Freemasonry. It is taking the understanding of the human condition, history, and occult knowledge, which is actually incredibly powerful knowledge that can in fact be used to free humanity, so
Absolutely.
That they can even occult it even further, keep it to themselves. And I believe one of the things that is evidenced by this is that when History Channel or anybody else ever interviews a Freemason, do they interview a third degree Freemason from a Blue Lodge or anything like that? No, it's always a 33rd degree from somebody from the Scottish Rite, which is only one branch of Freemasonry, albeit it's become the most powerful.
Yeah, sure. I mean, Frederick's new book, I mean, he's working on the war inside Freemasonry, right? So, you know, he's talking about all of these possible different factions that are fighting with one another. And that's that I'm sure that that's going on. No, I mean, without a doubt, because you do have definitely people that are trying to usurp this knowledge and hide it, you know, obfuscate it and keep it from the general public. The thing that I was saying about, James Wright, it was like, well, I'm not trying to call the guy out or anything like that, because I don't know what his story is or anything like that. But I always get really kind of shaky and questionable when somebody says there was an attack or an attempt made on my life. You know, I'm like, because to me, the BS meter starts going wild in my head. Why? Because you're making a claim that somebody made an attack on you that tried to kill you, right? The people that are in power flew planes into building on a mid-morning on a slow Tuesday in front of the damn world. They did this in front of the damn world, and you're telling me that they couldn't get to you. I'm sorry. I have to question that. I'm not saying he's a liar. I'm not trying to call him out. I wish him no malice or ill will or anything like that. You know, I try to go from, you know, by people's word. But that's just the BS meter starts going off.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, if they wanted you dead, you would be dead. You'd be dead like that.
I don't know. I think that there's actually a spiritual element underneath what's happening here, and that if you are walking right with God, amazing, miraculous things happen to prevent your death. Happens all the time. I see evidence of this happening everywhere. And we've got evidence. He's taken a whole bunch of shots of his car that it looks like something exploded from underneath. There was a bullet hole in the wheel axle. And it was actually a white van with tinted windows with a Freemasonic compass and square on the side that followed him on the LA highway on his way down to San Diego. And as he was taking the off ramp, he heard this big bang as the van went past him on the side, and his wheel kind of exploded, and he said that the whole car jumped upwards, like it exploded from underneath or something like that. And when he stopped, he had a Marine run across a parking lot off the side of the highway who saw the accident, and the Marine was actually a listener to my show and knew who James was and stood there to protect him at the time. And I'm just like, can you say Providence? You know, you know, it's an amazing story, and I've documented it, and the videos are on my YouTube channel if you do want to look at it. And his story is like, yeah, biggest Freemasonic whistleblower for over 100 years, and the last person, as I mentioned before, disappeared in a black coach in broad daylight with a Freemasonic compass and square on the side, and was never seen again. So. To say that Masons can kill everybody anytime and what have you, I think, I don't know, if you're doing, you know, the Lord's work, as it were, something always miraculously happens to protect you if you're aware of it, kind of thing. And James has kind of become very, very deeply spiritual as a result of some of these experiences. And I guess you kind of have to become like that. Just psychologically to survive, because like they said, religion's the opiate of the masses, and if you're in a lot of pain spiritually and psychologically, mate, you could be forgiven for taking a few opiates to dull that pain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, just to get back to what he was saying, you know, I guess what we're saying about this idea of the 33 and what you know, this is the, you know, whether it's satanic or not, I don't think it is. When you actually look at the number 33. 33 is an important number. Of course, this extends way beyond Freemasonry. This honestly has nothing to do with Scottish Rite Freemasonry. I mean, this goes way, way, way back. So we have to go to the original, you know, just like, I mean, looking at the etymological root of a word to really understand what this means, right? So when you look at the 33, the first thing we have to understand is you have 33 bones in your spinal column, with the spinal column being the central focus of all spiritual doctrine. I mean, the spinal column is, I mean, this is Hinduism, this is Egyptian, this is, you know, et cetera, et cetera. This is raising the Kundalini. This is, we see this in Sumer and Babylonian. This is the Caduceus. This is the staff of Hermes, et cetera, et cetera. This is the seven chakras, of course, with the, once again, the number seven being very important. Well, the reason that you have 32 and 33 degrees in the Scottish Rite Freemasonry, of course, is because this is referencing the fact that you have your cerebral spinal fluid that goes up and down. And this ascension process has been known for a very long time. So, you know, if the Scottish Rite Freemasonry are, you know, because this is associated, so, you know, quote unquote, with their number, whatever, and you and me, everybody is associated with the number 33. Every single person that's listening to this has the number 33 attached to them in some way, because this is directly referring to your spinal column. So when we say, you know, devil worshiping, or this is the, you know, 33 of, you know, whatever, having whatever Satan or whatever, it's, you know, ascend on you or whatever. It's like, I don't know. I think we just have to be very careful with that.
But again, you're oversimplifying it, and it's not just number. Yeah. It's not just the number, because there's rites of passage, rituals, books that you have to read, things you have to recite, and rituals you have to perform through each degree. That's what's ripening it up, not just the number alone.
Yeah. No, I know. I
am. Now, there was also another element as well here. Somebody told me once that the sun is to the power of 33 the size of the earth. Earth to the power of 33 is about the same circumference as the sun, something like that.
That could very well be. I'm not sure. I know the sun's core rotates once every 33 Earth days.
See, there you go. There's another one.
Exactly. I mean, there's a bunch of things with 33 that we can talk
quite
about.
Quite a few.
You know, in fact, the ratio of, you know, if you take, you know, just draw a circle with that's a unit 11, and draw a circle of a unit 3. Well, this is going to be a very, very close, I think, ratio. It's like 99.8% or something like that of the ratio to Earth to the Moon. And of course, 11 times 3 is 33. And so that's it's basically a number that allows you to understand, if you will, universal architecture. So anyway, beyond that, so I guess the thing I wanted to say, what I was trying to say about secret societies is that we have a tendency to demonize these things, and I don't think Freemasonry, once again, or Christianity, or Islam, or any of these things, in its original inception, I think it was to pass on holy information. It was occult information, information about understanding the human condition, and it's only the perversion of these. The other thing I wanted to say is I don't think all the secret societies that have been created were done so for this. You know what I mean? I mean, I don't think Skull and Bones has anything to do with passing on holy information or anything like that. I think this is an extremely corrupt organization that is looking for, taking over the world and globalization and that sort of thing.
So, I'm sure the Republican Party and Democrat Party were founded on the best of intentions too, even though the Constitution specifically warned against creating parties because it would corrupt the country.
Especially when you get into political discussions with people that that are very, once again, it's the dialectic, right? It's it's like two paths to the slaughterhouse kind of thing. Well, people argue about politics all the time. Well, we're not even supposed to be a democracy in the United States here. We're supposed to be a republic.
Yeah.
And so if you get into any political discussion at all, the first thing you should say is, well, do you believe in democracy? What kind of political system do we have here in the United States? Well, democracy. You're wrong. We're not supposed to, because according to the Constitution of the United States, to the republic for which it stands, one nation, we're supposed to be a republic. And a republic it's a libertarian point of view is what it is. It's understanding that every man is a sovereign individual. Every man is free. Every man has the creator, God-given rights.
Mm.
And those things are being usurped.
Even the Congress doesn't know that. One congressman stood up and said, can you name me the three branches of government?
Yeah.
and they said the executive, the judiciary, and the Senate. And he goes, no, actually, it's the states, the people, and the executive, the Congress, the state government, and then there's the people, right? Those are actually the three branches of government, and the people are supposed to rule over the states and the Congress, not Congress rule over the states and the people.
The one thing, since we're talking about this and we're kind of going off
subject
a little bit, but that's all right. It doesn't matter. It's fine. But the one thing that I always get when we talk about the gun control, debate, people are like, well, we got to have certain guns, you can't have guns, you can't have semi-automatics and things like that. It's like, okay, but you're making a distinction between the army, the armed forces, and the people. The people are the armed forces. The people are the government. So when you say, the armed forces can have this, but the people can't, that all you're doing is separating the people from their own government. You're taking the we the people and you're just, throwing it right out the window. Mm. And I haven't heard that in the gun debate at all. It's all about, it's not for hunting, or, the Constitution says this, or, this. Well, no, what you're doing is separating the people from the government. And that is the first problem right there.
Yeah. Now, can you name me a country that banned the use or ownership of weapons that didn't exterminate or enslave their population?
Oh, man. Yeah, isn't it? I mean, it was like Pol Pot and Stalin and like Hitler. All those guys, they took the guns,
all
right?
Even all the way back to freaking Edward the Longshanks told the Scottish they couldn't have swords or bows and arrows or anything like that before he ruthlessly enslaved and tried to exterminate them. Okay?
Oh, really?
Yeah. it's the same deal. And because people don't know the lesson of history, and I think specifically this is why history is kind of one of the dying forms in American education systems, is because it's this important. You can see what people are doing when they're doing it. That's what the lesson of history is. If somebody's banning guns, they want to enslave or exterminate you. It's not complicated.
Yeah, and going back to secret societies, going back to history, if you can, there's that Rage Against the Machine song, Testify. Who controls the past now, controls the future. Who controls the present now, controls the past. If you control the present, you control the past. And if you control the past, people can't have access to what happened. People can't have access to understanding, the guns were taken away, and guess what? Genocide, and that's exactly what's going on. Same thing in Freemasonry. These subversive movements, or whoever these people are, they're infiltrating this group and they're trying to, control that pass and not,
And I actually want to send this message out to current Masons. Your brothers are being corrupted by people who are infiltrating your organization. Okay? We're not saying you're bad. or anything of that nature. We're saying that you're being subverted, that all of the great lessons and everything that is of value within that organization is being captured and destroyed by people who want to destroy your brothers and mine. That's the end of the story. If you want Absolutely. Freemasonry to stop being falsely accused of being corrupt and what have you, then it's quite simple. Find those who are corrupt within the organization and expel them from the orders.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the Freemasonic credos is, I'm going to probably screw this up, but it's like, never look down at a man unless you're giving him a helping hand up, that kind of thing. I mean, that's that at the core, I think that's what, you know, Freemasonry is all about. So, yeah, I couldn't agree more, man. Let me just say this too, is that I got this, my quest through all of this information, which we haven't really even talked about, we'll get into it after this, but my quest through this information was a deeply psychological, deeply spiritual quest that brought me, I'll just be honest and lay my heart on the table here, it, you know, brought me into the hands of the divine, if you will. It's, and that's what I'm teaching now. And so their symbols, their ideas, things like that, and not just Freemasonry, it's a lot of the spiritualities and things like that, and the religions and psychology and all of this stuff, and nature. But you know, one of the things was Freemasonry. And I decoded this with a Freemason symbol. And so, and this has been one of the most amazing, magical, wonderful things that's ever happened to me. So all I can do is look and say, okay, well, if they were passing this information on and they're showing it in their symbols, I can only assume that at the very inception that this was a holy institution, you know? And if you drive into any town in, like, I live in Wisconsin currently, drive into any incorporated town in Wisconsin, you pull in, welcome to Albany, Wisconsin. Welcome to New Glarus, Wisconsin. There's going to be a Freemason symbol right there.
That's actually the same thing if you drive into any town in New Zealand, in some cases, nearly any suburb.
Yeah.
All right. We've come to the end of the first hour now. Marty, sure. Let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. If you, again, please, ladies and gentlemen, I do need your financial support in order to keep this show running. Rent, power, internet, you know, the whole nine yards and everything like that. It's all coming at me right now. So I would desperately ask and plead for your help to go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com, make a donation today, and preferably set up an automatic payment either through PayPal or preferably through that Kiwi Bank account, because they don't take a percentage like PayPal does, for only a few dollars a month, so that we can keep the show running, getting out important ideas, interviewing great thinkers of our time. Incidentally, like Marty Leeds, we'll be right back.
Okay, this one's for Gabby.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two with my very special guest, Marty Leeds. And, yeah, he's kind of like an investigator. That's why they called him Leeds.
Dun-dun-dun-dun-dun.
I'm just like a bad pun machine, you know. Like, in fact, it's funny. I've had at least half a dozen people tell me I should be writing those ridiculously lame Christmas cracker jokes. I think I can make a fortune.
Yeah, you do a lot better than this, huh? Hey, did you see that internet pun that they had with Putin, and he was on a Ritz cracker, and it was Putin on the Ritz? I don't know. It's terrible, but I thought it was hilarious.
Sorry, I don't quite get the joke about the Putin on the Ritz, but...
The Putin on the Ritz, like putting on the Ritz. You know that song that was that song in the '80s, right? Buster Poindexter or something. Was that one? Do you know what I'm saying?
Never.
Oh,
heard
anyway,
it. Might have
so
been.
I guess I shouldn't
time.
Try to make jokes.
I was born in 1984, which is kind of ominous considering my career choice. But yeah,
that's true. Wow.
Okay, so where were we? We've gotten past the old Freemason discussion here. Did you actually go to the point where we even discussed Jesus' name in the cipher and whatnot?
Yeah, you want to go into that? We can. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, because basically, what these what these secret societies are holding is, you know, knowledge of what it is to be a human being, the human condition, like you were saying, and what it also is the knowledge that they're holding, especially with gematria. We could go into symbol. Basically, the knowledge base, this occult knowledge base that these secret societies are holding and are trying to pass on are the exact sciences that are being completely dismissed by our modern world, by modern intellectualism, if you will. And these are sciences, symbolism, gematria, astrotheology, numerology, the four key ones there.
You know, this reminds me of what Mark Passio told me about natural law. When he was a priest at the Church of Satan, they very much believe in natural law, but they tell everybody else that natural law doesn't exist because no knowledge of natural law gives you power, and the Church did not want others having that power. So they told everybody the opposite of what they should believe.
Yeah, you know... Mark's last presentation, that New Age BS and the suppression of the sacred masculine, I mean, he just nailed it there. I mean, it was just fantastic. I mean, he just threw the ball up and just knocked it out of the damn park. I mean, the reason that he can lay out this stuff so well, why? Because he studied the occult. He was in it, you know. That's why he knows this stuff so well, because he knows exactly, number one, it's based on natural law. It's based on the natural sciences. And he, of course, he knows how this can be manipulated. And that's why, I mean, it's just a bang-up job. Did you watch the whole 7 hours? Yeah, you did, right? Yeah, it's just fantastic. I mean, I just applaud him. So, anyway.
During the start, maybe this happened to you as well. My neck got sore from nodding so vigorously. In agreement.
It was so funny too. I was like, I'm gonna sit down, I'll watch like 2 hours and then I'll come back to it, you know what I mean? I watched the whole thing. I literally just wasted, that's a terrible term. I spent a really great Saturday watching the whole thing. So
yeah
fantastic. Anyway. And I got the pleasure to speak with him at the Free Your Mind conference, so that was fantastic too, which those videos should be coming out fairly soon here. I know his was out and I watched that one too, which was great. So anyway, we were talking about, so the knowledge base, this occult or arcane science of old, is basically understanding the sciences that are being dismissed, and that what are called pseudosciences, right? This is the, you know, gematria, symbolism, numerology, astrotheology, right? Well, this is how the Bible is written. I mean, the Bible is written, the entire thing is a symbolic document. You know, I mean, every single line, every single letter, every single story is symbolic of something. It has nothing to do with any sort of exterior or, you know, exoteric idea. It's all mysticism and magic. And so this is what these people are trying to pass on. And of course, this is what's the Bible is being completely perverted by the organized religions of the world, of course, right? They're teaching you a literal story about, especially when you look at the New Testament, about a man named Jesus, and he's going to come flying back in the clouds and save 144,000 of you, right? And if you don't believe him, you're going to drown in a lake of fire or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And none of this is real. None of that is
real. Oh, well, you know, and by the way, we're not telling you this so that you'll blindly follow every single thing that we say and give us 10% of your income. No. It's because we actually give a frack about you while we live in the $2.7 million mansions that our church leaders live in. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing nefarious going on here, ladies and gentlemen. Just believe us, okay? That's what we're asking for, is belief and your money, okay?
Oh, so convenient that they're a tax shelter too. You know?
Like, oh yeah,
with their gold-plated thrones and yeah. It's just nuts. So.
Yeah. See, I feel that religion's been corrupted the same way that Freemasonry did, has been to a degree, don't you think? That there's real benefit within those religions. But the problem is because psychopaths always crave positions of power and control, they always wind up manipulating or stabbing their way into positions of power and control and then basically subvert and invert the intentions of everything.
Yeah, and especially, I mean, you're totally right, because, you know, like the Christianity, Islam, you know, all of these things, and Freemasonry, they are holding real knowledge, and that is exactly why they were infiltrated, why they, you know, they corrupted these organizations. I mean, to me, it's like, you know, these organizations originally were like, you know, your sweet grandma or something, you know, and then she got cancer, and then we look at your grandma, and it's like, oh, she's the devil, you know, or something like that, you know. But really, she's just a sweet lady. She bakes you apple pies and pinches your cheeks and gives you $50 every Christmas, you know, that sort of thing. So probably not the greatest analogy, but you get the point. So this is what these knowledge. Did you get me? Sorry.
not quite, but moving on.
Okay. Keep going. Yeah. This is why I don't host shows. Yeah. So yeah. They're holding the real knowledge of the Bible. Right. So let's take a look at the New Testament and let's take a look at Jesus Christ. We know all you have to do is, you know, just have a little bit of common sense, realize that this is allegory, that this is symbolism, that this is riddle, and that if you read any of these old texts, whether it's George Carey or Carl Anderson or Alvin Boyd Kuhn or, you know, even guys like Manly P. Hall and things like that, you'll know that Jesus Christ is a myth, a sun god myth. And this is a myth that's based around the processes and cycles of the sun. So. Of course, we have the myth of where the sun stops moving south on the horizon on December 21st, essentially, and the sun stops moving south, it's dead for 3 days, and then the sun rises again. And this is, of course, the motif of Jesus being nailed on the cross being the solstices and equinoxes. He was laid in a tomb for 3 days, and then he was resurrected. And of course, there's millions of people across the world that believe this stuff, right? As literalist. Well, then you see that, okay, this is an allegory for the sun, Jesus Christ. So, using this science, this gematria, this artistic science, if you will, what we can do is go into the name of Jesus Christ and find very particular numbers attributed to the sun in our sky, metrological numbers, numbers that dealing with like botany, astronomy, things like that. And we're going to go into all this. So, Jesus Christ. Once again, here's the cipher. A through M, N through Z. You can literally just put it right on top of one another and go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, resting on the G and T, and then 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. So Jesus, as it's spelled in the English, let me stop a second. I'm going to need to say this. I need to make this very clear. The only Bible that's worth its salt, the only Bible that really should be read when looking into this is the Authorized King James Holy Bible, period. Because this is why... Sorry. This is a Masonic edition Bible. This is the Authorized King James Version. And that's why that's on that cover right there. Because it's saying that the people that translated this from the original Greek scriptures knew of the mathematics behind it, and they were translating it with this understanding. And they understood the symbolism, the mythology, the numerology, the astrotheology, the psychology and philosophy behind it. All of the other versions of Bibles that are being printed today, whether it's God's Word version, the New Living Translation, any of these are complete distortions and bastardizations of the original text. That needs to be clarified because when you read those, especially reading them mathematically, when you read those, you will see that they are nothing alike. Even Genesis 1:1 is perverted in a lot of these books. And I just need to make that clear. So if you are going to look into this, do not even bother with any of those others because they didn't know it. They didn't know that there was mathematics behind it. So let's go into Jesus Christ. Lead character of the New Testament, of course, the savior of the Christian religion. Jesus Christ, the Son of God. So Jesus is 45666. Of course, we have the number 666 right in the name of Jesus. Of course, St. John in 13:18 says, here is wisdom, let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is a number of man, and his number is 666. And St. John is very clearly saying in that verse that 666 is a number of wisdom and a number of man. It's a number of you. And the beast in that verse is the beast that rises in the east. It's the enormous sun. It's the ball of light that we revolve around. And so it's a number of wisdom. So the fact that we find the number 666 in the name of Jesus is very important. So I'm going to just go to Christ quick here. Is Christ is C-H-R-I-S-T, and this is 365567. Okay, I'm just going to say that. So let's go to Jesus first. Let's take a look at Jesus. Jesus, if, just as you look on your phone, when you look on your phone right now, you have nine numbers spread out, and it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Right? This motif you actually find in what's known as the Christian angelic hierarchy. And it was this nine angels, and they were split up into three levels, just like you see on your phone once again. Well, if you add these numbers across, 1 + 2 + 3 = 6, 4 + 5 + 6 = 15, and 1 + 5 = 6, and 7 + 8 + 9 = 24, and 2 + 4 = 6. So therefore, you're getting literally the number 1 through 9, 6, 6, 6. And if you add 1 + 2 + 3 + 4 + 5 + 6 + 7 + 8 + 9, it equals 45. So just as it's seen on your phone, just as it's seen in the Christian angelic hierarchy, this stems from the Greek and Egyptians, of course, you get the numbers 4, 5, and 6, 6, 6. And this is how you break up the name Jesus syllabically. Jesus, 4, 5, 6, 6, 6. So and what that is basically the crux of numerology. I'm not going to really go into it here, but that's what it's showing in his name. So what we're going to do is multiply Jesus, right? So Jesus is 4, 5, 6, 6, 6, just as we just said. 4 × 5 × 6 × 6 × 6 is a number 4,320. Well, this number 432 is extremely important. And what you can do is look at how important this number is in different scales. So for instance, the number 432 in somatics, which is the science of looking at hertz or wavelengths and seeing geometric forms that arise from this. Did you have something to say?
I was actually just about to say the 432 hertz frequency is like a healing energy.
Yeah, and this really stems from looking at visually, seeing that there are symmetrical or geometric forms that arise when we hit certain frequencies. And what this is showing is that there, especially when you understand that nature is built with geometry and number, that you can see that 432 becomes very important. So we see 432 in somatics. So this number 432 at different scales. So we can look at 432 in somatics. The degree of phylotaxis, and we're going to get back into this in the name of Christ. The degree of phylotaxis is a degree in which leaves will arrange themselves around a plant, right? So if you look at a plant, you'll see that the leaves will not overlap each other, that they'll arrange each other as they swirl up around the plant, around a flower, whatever, in a very particular way. And this degree is measured at 137.5 degrees. Well, 137.5 degrees, a constant in nature, multiplied by pi, one of the most important mathematical constants, gives you the number 432.025. So we can see constant in nature, constant in mathematics. All we did is use the holy cross of multiplication, and we came up with 432. So once again, it goes beyond the opinion or idea of man of what we think about it. That's just nature. For 4,320, we're just going to look at it at a different scale. 4,320. 4,320 is two precessional ages in what's known as the precession of the equinoxes, right? It's this great span of time. I'm sure you know about it. A lot of people got hip to it because of 2012, known as the Yuga cycle in Hindus. The Greeks, they had it as the Platonic cycle or the great year. Well, what it was is basically this great span of time of 25,920 years. Well, two precessional ages would be 4,320. Once again, just a different scale of 432. 43,200. Once again, just going to go up another octave, if you will, in the base 10 system, if you will. 43,200. Well, this is just the seconds in a half day. So 60 seconds in a minute, 60 minutes in an hour, 12 hours in a half day. 60 times 12 is 43,200. What else? The Great Pyramid of Giza is a scale model of one hemisphere of the Earth. And if we take the Great Pyramid of Giza and we multiply it by 43,200, its base is going to sit on the equator, and where the missing capstone is on the top would hit the North Pole. So once again, all based on this number 432. Now we can go to 43,200, right? Once again, just going up in scale. This is the radius of the sun. And of course, we are dealing with the Son of God, and this is all found in the name of Jesus. So that's just the name of Jesus. We haven't even got to Christ yet, mind you. Christ. Christ is C-H-R-I-S-T, being 365. 365, how many days in the solar year are there? 365. Of course, we're dealing with the sun. And then the next three numbers are 5, 6, 7. I-S-T is 5, 6, 7. 5 + 6 + 7 is 18. And Jesus went missing for 18 years in the Holy Bible, in the New Testament. He goes missing at age 12, goes missing 18 years. We have no idea what happened to him. All of a sudden, he shows back up at 30. So 18 is a very important number. Why? Because he went missing at age 12, and started his ministry at age 30. Well, there's 12 ages of the zodiac and 30 degrees of each age. 12 times 30 is 360 degrees of a circle. And of course, this is the 12 months of the year. This is the seasons of our year. And so that's all encoded within the mythology, and not only the mythology, but also his name. So what we can do is multiply Christ now. So 3 times 6 times 5 times 5 times 6 times 7 is this number 18,900. So we took the numbers of Christ, we multiplied them. We get this number 18,900. Who cares, right? What does 18,900 mean to you? Nothing. Now take the square root of 18,900, and we get the degree of Philotaxis, 137.48. 137.5 is the degree.
Isn't that what the IRS makes us do?
What's that?
Philotaxis?
Damn, you're quick, man. the fact that this is encoding in his name. Oh, where does this come from? What does this have to do with Freemasonry, right? 137.5 is the degree of Philotaxis. Well, this is open to 47 degrees, and this is, of course, a square. We all know a square is 90 degrees.
So 90, for the radio listeners, he's pointing at the Masonic compass and square, and the compass is open at 30 degrees, and the square is at 90 degrees, yeah.
Sorry. I apologize for that. I forgot that people weren't watching this. So yeah, the compass is actually open to 47 degrees.
47, sorry.
Yeah, no problem. And then the square is open to 90 degrees. So 90 plus 47 is, of course, 137. You're only 0.5 off. And so not only do we find this name in the degree of Philotaxis, we find this degree in the name of Christ. We find it associated with 432, and then we find it right on the cover of the Holy Bible, right? And then in the Freemason symbol. So by the way, on the back of the $1 bill, so the compass was open to 47 degrees. That angle of that pyramid, guess what angle it's at?
47.5 degrees? No.
47. Yeah, okay. So exactly.
Well, and also there's a lot of encoded numerology in the back of the $1 bill as well. I think like there's an eagle holding 13 arrows and it's holding an olive leaf branch that has 13 leaves on it, and I forget the rest of them, but apparently there's the number 13 repeats itself on the $1 bill 13 times.
Yeah. And of course, we split our alphabet in the letters into 13 letters and 13 letters, two blocks of 13, right? The Great Pyramid of Giza, which is what is being shown on the Eye of Providence or the All-Seeing Eye of God. Well, the Great Pyramid of Giza is 13 square acres, I guess, something like that, I want to say. So, you see this repeated 13, 13. And the reason is because, once again, this is all cryptically encoding things that are within our alphabet. By the way, get back to this. Jesus was the Lord, right? Jesus is Lord. L-O-R-D is 2254. This equals 13. God, the two names that we find in the Holy Bible, G-O-D is 724. This equals 13. So Lord and God equal 13. We split our alphabet in 13 and 13 letters. Of course, Jesus Christ is 12 around 1, which means that his posse was 13 dudes. You know, so all of this stuff is, once again, numerical. It's numerological. So getting back to Christ. Jesus is 27, so 4, 4, 5, 6, 6, 6 equals 27, and Christ is 32. Well, 27 plus 32 is 59. There are 59 beads in a Christian rosary. So there's this rosary that people have. There are millions of these. My mother has one, and I think she got it from her mother, and her mother got it from her grandma. So very old rosary has this very specific number. So we have these people that are going to church every single day. They're kneeling down. They're listening to this pastor, minister, preacher, whatever it is, and they're sending their thoughts out to this man named Jesus who's going to come and save them. And they're holding this rosary that has 59 beads, having absolutely no idea why there are 59 beads in this rosary. And we do the numerology of Christ with a cipher begotten from the Holy Bible, mind you, and we find 59. Pretty interesting. Jesus equals 27. This is the kicker. Jesus equals 27. Christ equals 32. 27 times 32 is 864. And the diameter of the sun in English miles is 864,000 miles. So here we have the Jesus Christ, the Son of God, and we look, and it equals 864. Interesting thing, the there's a the, you know, the Toltec complex, Teotihuacan. They have it's Mesoamerica. They have this huge complex, and they have two pyramids, and one's called the Pyramid of the Sun, and the other one's called the Pyramid of the Moon. Well, this whole complex is built with what's known as STUs and standard Teotihuacan units. Well, the Pyramid of the Sun is built with 864 of them, and that's just the measurement. So we have this Toltec complex that's referencing the sun. 864, we go to the sun, it equals 864,000 miles, and then we look at Jesus Christ, and we multiply his name, and it equals 864.
Mm.
Now, yeah, and
well, see,
mind
that's
you,
the scale of STU, but you tell that to an academic, and they'll just tell you to STFU.
Yeah, that's about it, right? Yeah, I mean, I don't know, because, I mean, I'm basically ignored by all academia. I mean, no, I'm pretty much unknown to these people, so I don't know what they would actually think about it.
Like,
but
if you weren't ignored by academia, I think it would damage your credibility or something, you know? It's just like, academics listen to this guy, oh, he must be full of crap, you know?
Yeah. So, oh, by the way, sun in the cipher... Right, we talked about Lord being 13, God equaling 13, Sun is S-U-N, it's 661. This equals 13. So, once again, so the idea of all of this stuff being a coincidence, right, first and foremost, is absurd. It's absurd. It really is. I mean, I would challenge anybody to say that this is a coincidence, because that defies the very definition of what a coincidence is. You're talking about very specific numbers. First of all, I would need to say this. Anybody can do this math. I just explained the cipher. You can go to my site and look at the cipher. You can go and write this down and double check all of this math yourself. And I encourage you to do that. I really encourage you to do that, because I don't want you to trust me. I want you to be able to do it by yourself. And you don't need to believe me. You don't need to buy my book in order to do this. You just need to go and take some time to do it. Instead of watching CSI Miami tonight or whatever the hell it is you were going to watch, you know, go and check this out, you know.
Incidentally, so, I asked a Freemason friend of mine the other day, like, he works on construction sites and stuff, and I asked him, any of the new kids that are coming in to do all the construction work, can any of them do even basic maths without using a calculator? And he's like, no, not at all. So I think you're wrong, Marty. Not everybody can do this maths.
You're right. That's a good point. Well, if you have a calculator, you can do this math anyway, so... But really, I mean, when you look at it, it's all add, subtract, multiply, and divide. I mean, it's not even subtracting or dividing. It's just adding and, well, think about it this way, too. It's adding and multiplying. That's all we just did. We did, besides square rooting once, we added and multiplied. That's all we did. What are the symbols for add and multiply? They're crosses. You know, so you see how deep the symbolism goes. It's, you know, it's no joke. I mean, these people took numerology very seriously. And so whoever crafted the name of Jesus Christ, when they were translating it from, once again, from that original Greek, were very, very intelligent. They were extremely intelligent.
Is that why when people take his name in vain, they get very cross about it?
Let's talk about the spiritual meaning of Jesus Christ, if you will. And what I got from it, and this is, I'm so glad you actually said that, because when you take the Lord's name in vain, two names of the God, or two names for God, just as we just said in the Holy Bible, right? Lord and God. Well, Abraham, who founded the Abrahamic religions, right? Islam, Judaism, Christianity, he was a monotheist, right? I mean, that's what the whole idea is, that there's one God, right? And then, of course, the Islam say, well, that's our God. That's our interpretation. There's Judaism, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And then, we have all this infighting. The thing with the one God is that there's two names in the Bible. Well, if there's two names for God in the Bible and there's only one God, why would he have two names? What's the point of that? It doesn't make any sense, any logical sense. If there's one God, he should have one name, right? There's a reason for this, and there's a spiritual reason for this. This is talking about the fact that we find this same thing in Hinduism. In Hinduism, there was known as Brahman and Atman. Brahman was the cosmic God. It was the whole thing. It was as far out as your thoughts could go, as far out as we can see into the universe. It's all it was, shall be, and is. It's omnipotent, omniscient, omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent. It's everything.
So are you talking about the difference between what God is, God encompassing everything, and then the difference being the will of God, right? Lord is the will of God and God is everything kind of thing. Is that sort of where you're getting at?
No. Let me try to clarify this. So God, the term of God, we're going into Hinduism here. I'm sorry. Brahman is the cosmic God. Brahma literally means cosmos. That's what it means. So it means everything. Atman was the God that was at man. It's the God that dwelled within the human temple. And so there was two aspects of this wholeness of God, the monotheistic, and monotheism is extremely important. And it's not the God of the Islams or the Jews or the Christians or the Muslims, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It's not any of those gods. It's the idea that there's a oneness and a wholeness and an interconnectivity to our entire universe. And this is the Brahman. This is the cosmos. And then that Brahman focuses on one central conscious point, and that conscious point is the conscious point of the human being. And that is the Atman. The exact same thing is being expressed in the Holy Bible. God is the whole. It's the wholeness. It's everything. It's all it was, shall be, and more is, etc., etc., right? And the Lord is the Lord within. And so the Lord Jesus Christ is to recognize the Christ consciousness within. It's to recognize the elevated spirit of the human being. So not taking the Lord thy God is how it's said in the Bible. The Lord thy God's name in vain is to say, there's a deeper meaning here. It's saying, do not take your own name in vain. Do not devalue yourself. Do not look, you know what I mean? Recognize that you have that divine consciousness within you, and don't devalue yourself. Recognize that eternal spirit within. And that is the spiritual message behind this.
Well, isn't that what vanity is only appreciating what's on the outside and ignoring what's on the inside? Hence taking the Lord's name in vain, taking your insides and making it vanity.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why it's the idea. And the idea of, you also hear the idea of fearing God, right? Or you're fearing the Lord. The first step is to fear the Lord. Well, what are you talking about? To fear, you're going to fear yourself? Well, guess what? Anything that's worth doing, when you start to do it, there's fear, right? There's trepidation. First time I ever stepped on stage as a musician, I was scared blankless. You know what I mean? The first step in overcoming something is to fear it. I've sat at the bottom of a 12,000-foot mountain with 60 pounds on my back and looked up and been like, oh, my God, am I going to bust a knee? Am I going to get up there? Am I going to wuss out? You know what I mean? And there was fear. And then what do you have to do? Overcome it. That's what you have to do. So this is as soon as you penetrate all of that literalism, there's a really, really deep spiritual message there. And this is the things that is being completely polluted by, once again, the Freemasons, the Vatican, etc.
Now, the manipulation of humans through marketing, I just interviewed Suzanne Posel from the USIndependent.com yesterday, and she said they try to keep you in marketing in four states of being, either fear, rage, alcohol, and I think there was one other, or drugs. Yeah, alcohol or drugs, fear or rage, and those are the only four things that they try to promote through marketing, more or less. Those are the states that they wish you to be in. They either want you doped up, drunk as hell, afraid, or enraged, right? Those are the only things you can easily manipulate people under those circumstances. If somebody's afraid, you can tell them what to be afraid of and point them in that direction. Somebody's angry, you can tell them what to be angry at and point them at the direction. If somebody's drunk, you can show them there's a toilet to throw up in and point them in that direction, and so on and so forth. And I believe that the manipulation of the human race is as old as time itself. You know what I'm saying? You know, it's actually almost, it's a power base. Knowing how humans work, knowing what our influences are, and more to the point, knowing when we're under the influence so that you can inject your influence into this. And I know this from personal experience because I don't know about you, Marty, but every now and again I do get the opportunity to go out and you know, boogie on the dance floor and have a few drinks with a few people and what have you. And sober, these people who I speak to will call me a conspiracy theorist, will call me crazy and what have you. Drunk or stoned, on the other hand, they listen to my ideas with interest, they offer their own insights and what have you. It's this total polar shift in the ability for them to be receptive to information that they would ordinarily reject, and I think that's what marketing really is.
Yeah, as far as like drug use and things like that, or any sort of like let me step back a second. Since we were on the spiritual thing, this idea of feeding those lower animal natures, the atavistic carnal natures, we can understand this through the chakra system. And this, you don't even have to bring any woo-woo stuff into this. There's an understanding that the endocrine system that is attached to your spine, that your brain sends the cerebrospinal fluid and it sends information out there, right? Well, anything that's lower than the heart chakra, right? Anything that's lower than the heart is, in Hinduism, it's the Muladhara, the Svanasana, and the Manapura. These are your lower animal natures. So the people that are advertising to us are trying to feed us that stuff. They're saying, feed that gut, feed that sexual drive. Here's a bunch of alcohol that's going to go right into your stomach. They don't talk about the heart. They don't talk about the mind. They don't talk about elevating the spirit. You'll never get that from advertising. Why? Because they know that that's what they're feeding. So there's a spiritual component even to that, an understand. And that is, by the way, the seven chakras are just littered in revelation. I mean, it's all over the Bible in many respects, but that's all revelation is about, is the psychology of lifting the self up into the divine and recognizing one's own sovereignty, spirituality, and that you are crafted by that great creator being. That's a nature force, if you will. That's Allah, Mu, Jehovah, Jah, Ra, whatever you want to believe. It's not any name for God, by the way, falls remarkably and ridiculously short in identifying it or defining it. You can't define it. I just wanted to say that. But that's what the advertisers are doing. They're feeding to those lower animal natures, and we want to lift that up, and we want to lift it with our hearts up into and illuminate ourselves. So.
Now you were talking about the chakra systems and how revelations actually goes into those and explains. I'm curious. Could you explain?
Yeah. How do I want to go into this? The number seven is extremely important. Every time you see the number seven, just like this, the system that of our language is built off seven. Anytime you see seven, it really, what it's talking about is not just the chakra system. It's talking about the relationship that man has to his environment, right? There's six directions of space. Forward, reverse, up, down, left, and right. And those six directions of space come onto a confluence. And that's a center point. And that center point is the seventh point. And that seventh point is the consciousness of the human being. This is the X, Y, and Z axis, with their opposites and directions coming in. And this is, so it's understanding the three-dimensional mathematics of you. That's what it's understanding. And how you, go about in the world and do your business. And this is the motif that we see in the very opening pages of Genesis. God did his work in 6 days and rested on the seventh. And people take this literally, like God actually, formed the world in day one and then, day two. And what it's really talking about is the three-dimensional mathematics of the Lord, or the great divine character that is you. Mm. So it's beyond just the chakras. Now, if I may say this, so I don't lose my thought here anyway, our entire world is built off seven. Not only do we have seven chakras, seven points of the endocrine system, our three-dimensional mathematics and resting on a center point, which is known as the axis point. Axis is an anagram for six. Is the alpha. It's you. Our whole world is built off seven. The human being, as far as I know, is the only creature that actually sees a rainbow. Rainbow is seven colors. The planets that we can see in our sky is of sevenfold nature. The heavenly spheres. Sun, Mercury, Venus, Moon, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, seven planets. These were seven planets known by shamans and alchemists of all time, So what we can see in our sky is of a sevenfold nature. So we have the rainbow. We have the seven notes of the major scale, seven deadly sins, etc. So anytime you see the number seven, I could just pick up Revelation. Actually, I need a smaller version because I don't want to pick this up. But you just read Revelation and you will see seven again, seven, 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 again and again. And this is what it's talking about, is about this number is an integral part of understanding what it is to be a human being. The number seven, S-E-V-E-N, 6-5-5-5-1 equals 22. And 22 divided by 7 is 3.142. It's pi. So that's how understanding numerology and the qualitative aspect of numbers can help you understand your environment. And this is why, honestly, numerology is so important. Numerology just means ology, meaning the study of, and numer, meaning number. That's all it means, man. So you're telling me that how many people would be like, oh, he's a numerologist, don't listen to him. Well, all I'm doing is studying number. What's so wrong with that? As far as I'm concerned, That's mathematics. Do you know who else was a numerologist? Pythagoras, one of the greatest mathematicians of all time, and he was well known to be a mystic and a numerologist. So hopefully that answers that question anyway.
It does, actually. Now, of course, this goes back into, and I hate to repeat this, the occulting of knowledge, to secret it away. And I believe that I'm, as Mark Passio described himself as well, a de-occultist. We're attempting to de-occult this knowledge, to give it out to people. I remember that the accumulation of power, in order to accumulate it for yourself, you need to take it away for others. Now, in order for everybody to share this knowledge, it means everybody would be powerful and I wouldn't be able to have power over any of them. And this is the... I think this is the important perspective of our time, in fact, to believe that power should be shared, not monopolized.
Yeah, I mean, that's my goal. I want to teach this stuff to people because I know that I'm not manipulated anymore by any sort of advertising. I mean, it's the idea of waking up and really what it is. And when you understand this, especially the occult body of knowledge, you can't be manipulated by it because you're smart enough to know what they're doing. You know, I was working one time and I was with my friend and we were putting up this sign and there was this big old McDonald's billboard, right? And it was big old red, and there was this girl, she was probably between 18 and 21, you know, that real, you know, young age, just to have enough, just old enough to have sex with, but, you know, young enough and still sexy, and her breasts are just laid out, and she's holding this big old Big Mac or something like that, and this big red billboard, and I was talking to her, but I'm looking at this, and I'm like, all they're doing right now is feeding these lower animal carnal natures. Here's the food. Here's the sex. Here's the, and then of course even the color red. If you understand, you know, even
passion,
a little bit
the woman
about,
in the red dress. You know, the distraction,
absolutely.
The deceiver.
You know? And so, how many people will look at that and just pass right by it? It'll enter their conscious, enter their subconscious, and have no recognition of it whatsoever. I see that, and I'm like, oh, that's straight-up manipulation. And people can learn that.
I only just had this realization the other day, is that advertisements are starting to drive me nuts, and I ain't even watching no TV anymore. I barely even listening to any radio. But still, advertisements are everywhere. They're all down the columns of your Facebook. They're on billboards on the side of the road, bus stations. Everything is freaking advertising. You get all these damn things in your letterbox and everything. And I figured, and just as you're saying it now, I figured out why it's driving me so freaking mad. It's because I'm allergic to being manipulated. I really hate being manipulated. And I know that I'm consciously aware that it's trying to manipulate me. That's why I hate it so much. Even a little bit in my face just pisses me off.
Yeah, allergic to being manipulated. That's a great way to put it, by the way. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. A lot of times the people that are awake or a lot of the people that are listening to the show that are like hip to a lot of this stuff, you know, I think we have a tendency to live in a bubble in many respects. It's like, according to my Facebook page, everybody's awake. Everybody, you know, tomorrow it's going to be a wonderful world. But when I live in southern Wisconsin right now and I can't talk to anybody about this stuff, anybody. I mean, no one wants to listen to it. Even if I start getting into any sort of spiritual ideas or not even any of that, just numerology, like the phalanges of your hand, understanding that the sections here of your hands have to do with universal mathematics. That's they don't want to listen to that, you know? And so I feel like it's almost a full-time job for me to try to put out as much information to try to get to grab the ear of as many people as I can while I'm still here and have breath in my lungs, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this is actually the power of the internet. And one of these realizations I had was it last night or this morning? I forget. But it occurred to me that when you wake up to the truth about really anything, any deep occult knowledge and the way the world truly works and what have you, it's like taking your old self and your old part of the world and surgically removing it from you, and that's inherently traumatic. And what's worse is that it compounds onto that, because not only do you realize that your entire life has been full of crap and all of this stuff has passed you by up until this point, so that you actually kind of have to start again. It's like high school was a waste of time, so was kindergarten, so was your parents' teachings. Almost everything that you've ever done in your entire life has been for naught. That in itself is an inherently traumatic realization. What's even worse than that is when you're surrounded by people who have not yet had that realization themselves, who think that you're crazy for having it, and they ostracize you, they demonize you, and you feel really alone, and you feel really depressed about the fact that you're really alone, and you feel really angry about the people who are ostracizing you and demonizing you, and then you get worse and worse and worse. And it occurred to me that this is the point of my show, to just offer my hand out and offer my ears and the sounds of my voice to help all of those people who went through that same traumatic wake-up experience, all of those of you who are feeling alone right now, who your family call you nuts and what have you. This show is for you. It's not to wake people up who haven't had this experience. This is not for the uninitiated. These are the people who have gotten over themselves to the point where they just need to know how to cope with the information. Somebody asked me the other day, Vinny, what do I do once I've learned all this information? I go, well, it's a three-step process, okay? Well, four steps if you include the waking up in the first frickin' place. Step two is learning how to deal with the fact that you know this information now, okay? Coping with it. Humor's a good tool for that. It's by no means the only one. You can also get drunk every day and stoned every day. It's the only way to tell
that.
and a lot of us do go through that process before we start to develop other coping mechanisms, because you realize that if you're using a coping mechanism which destroys your mind and or your body, it's not exactly a sustainable one. And then step three and four, figure out how you alone can contribute to making a difference. That's step three, and then step four is actually making that difference. And that's the pinnacle anybody can ever achieve in their life, is to change something that actually affects the human race in a positive way.
It's one of the noblest of deeds, you know. So, I mean, you know what you're saying here with step three and four, it's just right on. I mean, it really is. I mean, if you can, once again, that goes back to that Freemasonic credo. It's like you never look down on another human being unless you're giving him a hand up, you know. How many researchers out? This is something that I've been really. You just posted this on your Facebook page about being, you know, kind of alone or whatever. Did you, like, in the last week or something like about that? About how your people are not understanding you and they're calling you a conspiracy theorist, and then it kind of puts you in this closet or whatever, you know, kind of puts you in the shadows. And I mean, that's why, I mean, the internet is such a powerful tool about reaching out to people. And I think that as people that are de-occulting this stuff or whatever, or bringing this information out, I think we have a responsibility to our fellow man. I think we have a moral obligation to our fellow man. And I don't know, I just need to say this, man, because this has really been just ticking me off. I could name probably 10 or 15 really good researchers, people that have read a lot of books, done really a lot of really good research, that are, you know, have podcasts or whatever. They've done lectures and all of this stuff. And they're really intelligent people. And yet, people will come to their Facebook page or their YouTube page, and they'll disagree with something that they say, or they'll challenge on something that they say, and their initial reaction is, moron, idiot, you know? Well, that's not helping anything, because guess what, man? You were that moron at one point. You were that ignorant person at one point. You were that fool at one point. And to put all you're doing by doing that is putting your former self down. That's all you're doing. So we have an obligation not to act like that, you know, to follow the golden rule. And treat people as you would want to be treated, and to help lift them up, to teach the ignorant, to tolerate the intolerance, knowing that if we can keep working and reclaim this thing from the people that have taken control of it. If you know what I'm saying, I mean, I think that's a very important point, you know. I gotta say, thank you for what you're doing, by the way.
That said, there's a balance to that equation as well, because not only are you trying to help up your potential allies and what have you, is you also have to expose and indeed help to disempower those who are actually the enemies of humanity, psychopaths and whatnot. No amount of knowledge will stop a psychopath from being a psychopath. They won't wake up one day and just suddenly go, oh my god, I'm a completely psychotic pedophile ring running scumbag and I feel really bad about it. They can't do that psychologically. They're part of their brain that has that emotion, that has that self-realization, that recognition of morality doesn't exist. It's not physically there in these people. And the real problem, as I mentioned in the first hour, is that these people wind up in power of our institutions in and of themselves. This is why I, as we were talking about before, like when I was criticizing Freemasonry, you interpreted it very, very quickly as anybody who believes in the integrity of a general section of any institution instantly reject any criticism of the entire institution as a whole, because it's seen as criticizing every single person within that institution, whereas it's not that case. However, we can recognize that an institution has been corrupted from a very, very small minority at the top, and people are perfectly capable of accepting that level of criticism rather than throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And that's part of what I'm starting to learn to do, is differentiate between attacking an institution that is full of people and simply attacking individuals within that institution that are full of crap.
I would add this, and the really good thing that's on our side is most people are not psychopaths.
Yes.
You know, that's what's the really great thing. And so I guess what when I was saying that, let me clarify this, is that when somebody comes to a YouTube page or a Facebook page or whatever, it makes those, chances are that person is not a psychopath. They're just ignorant. They're just naive. They just haven't woken up, or they just haven't learned things yet. And so I think it's our responsibility to teach them, at least lay them out, lay out information for them, at least be kind to them. You know, yeah, there are psychopaths, and there's nothing you're going to do about it. You know, that's just the roll of the dice and just what happens. You know, I also would say this. I don't think that you. This comes from, Robert Buckminster Fuller. You never change things by fighting the existing reality. You change things by making a new model, which makes the old model obsolete. And so my goal, is not to necessarily, not that there's anything necessarily wrong with protesting or anything like that, because I know you're a big protester and anything like that, but I want to build the new model. And just let this thing shine, and then people like, okay, that makes a whole lot more sense. And, help build that as opposed to try to cut down the people. Because if there are so many more of those real people that are searching for answers, they're going to be drawn to that new model as opposed to me spending all my breath and time trying to attack that 1% that, that runs the world. I think unification and not necessarily agreeing with everybody or anything like that, but I think declaring our independence en masse is going to do way more than ever than, the protesting or, that sort of thing is going to work, if you know what I'm saying.
Well, see, yesterday I declared war on the corrupt media institutions in this country, and I specifically said that I believe that there are elements within the media in New Zealand that are corrupt, that do distort stories, and do, in fact, refuse to help those who need their stories told. And I'm declaring war on that particular section of the New Zealand media. Not all New Zealand media, not all New Zealand blogosphere, just on those who basically are self-identified manipulators.
Mm-hmm. And honestly, what you're doing is really great, because not only are you saying, hey, look at those people that are corrupt, look at those people that are manipulating the news, look at that, but you're also providing another service to say, hey, here's the other side, here's the new model. And how many people are drawn to this new model, right? I mean, you have more listeners than the media, don't you?
What's real funny is one of the biggest left-wing bloggers in this country criticized the protest that I was on and said, oh, I've seen better numbers at a chemtrail protest. And incidentally, I've led those chemtrail protests. So he was publicly taking a dig at me in a kind of underhanded sort of way. And he got... I think 2 likes on that Facebook post. I put 1 post criticizing the media, and it's up to like 80 likes. So here's the thing. This is a realization that I came to a number of years ago before I even really started to get to this level that I am now, is that you win by fighting back. Okay? And in so doing... we've already won, haven't we? Because we are fighting back. All we're doing is going through the motions here. We're seeing the death of the scumbaggery, and we're seeing new life being energized into those with, as Mark Passio calls it, a moral obligation to do good, a moral obligation to think for ourselves. And my brother argued with me on this. I said that if you're fighting for freedom... by default, you are fighting against tyranny. And this is where that Eckhart Tolle kind of thing comes in. You know, don't fight the existing system, make a new system that has it obsolete. I believe that by making a new system, you automatically are fighting against the old system, because the old system will attack you to protect itself, won't it? So not only have you got to create a new system, but you also have to come up with a defensive tactic in order to prevent your new system from being destroyed by the old one, which will wish to suppress anything that challenges its current dominance, whether that be psychological or physical or political.
Yeah, I mean, and the old system is falling. You know, it really is. I mean, major media, news media is just terrible. And I think people, I mean, the only people that really watch it anymore are starting to age. You know, I mean, even my parents are getting to hip to the fact that it's like, you know, Brian Williams doesn't have anything important to say. All he's doing is reading a teleprompter and telling them, you know, telling people what he's told to say, you know, and people are recognizing that. I mean, if you didn't have the major media, right, where would people get their news? Well, they would have to go to all of these different independent sources that are free to say whatever they want, save for the FCC, which is, once again, the FCC in control, right, by the government. I mean, what are they doing? What are they doing? They're spellbinding us. You can't say certain words. Why? Why not? Well, because we say. So we're going to control the language, and we're going to control what you can say. Mm. So we even got to get rid of that, because that's just nonsense.
I have a message for the FCC. F you!
My acronym is one letter short, bro.
You know, I can't really put it in more succinct words than that. You know, it's pretty straightforward, isn't it?
Yeah. And this idea of, once again, we're talking to get back to gematria a little bit, and talking about words and word manipulation and really spellbinding people. That's really, I mean, the Holy Bible is called the Gospel, which is nothing more than the ghost spell. That's what it's saying, you know. Seances or sentences, sibyls come from syllables, you know, this sort of idea. Rites come from writing. The fact that our language binds us in so many different ways. The FCC is just one example of that. But our language binds us in so many ways. I mean, look at legalese, right? I mean, you have an entire dictionary that's created, that's redone like every single year, right?
To make it's very ironic that they call it legalese, because there's nothing easy about it. It's quite difficult, in fact. Yeah.
I mean, think about this. I mean, you have all of our laws written in this language, right? And so not only can we not understand the language, you have to have a lawyer's degree to even understand it, and those people can't even understand it. You have all of these laws. I mean, let's see, 2012 it was, there were 60,000 laws passed in the United States alone. 60,000 laws. And of course, those laws are how many pages thick that they, you know, the Congress or whatever, the Senate doesn't even read it. And my thing is like, okay, well, we should be able to just dismiss this whole thing. Why? Because the human being can't remember that much. So we're bound by laws. And I mean, I can remember like 23
I love the saying, ignorance of the law is no excuse, when they pass 60,000 laws in a year and the Congress doesn't even freaking read them before passing them.
Yeah, I mean, can you recall or recite 60,000 of anything? Anything? Like, I mean, if you know, I mean, I can't. And so therefore, we are bound by these laws. And that is all it is somebody writing something down. And so we, so this is the power of our own language, you know.
Hmm. Well, that brings us close to the end of the second hour here as well with the really quite compelling Marty Leeds. And I just was speaking to my wife over the first hour break there, and she was doing a bit of analysis of our household finances. And we're about $900 in the red for this week alone, ladies and gentlemen. So I'm actually going to have to really step it up a bit and try and solicit some more donations out of the audience. And I apologize for putting you under this obligation, but we've got rent to pay. The power bill just came in. Water bill will be coming in next. Sarah's vehicle doesn't have a registration, so that means she could get pulled over at any point by a police officer and get a $700 fine or something of that nature. So that needs to be done as well, and this is not including food. So we need $900 within the next 3 to 4 days if we're just going to stay above water. And I hate to put this obligation on you, ladies and gentlemen, but it is not a choice. It is a lack of option. So please go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com right now. As soon as you've heard this, this is your obligation, your moral obligation to support me and make sure that this show continues. And it is a very time-sensitive thing as well, so I'd appreciate it if you would also share this out with other people and let them know about this crisis that we're in as well. We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com.